This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. A Facebook post goes viral, a normal mother ends up in jail, and a local business is left scarred by false accusations.
First impulse, everybody believes what they read, and so from that point on, we had a lot of people doubting the care that we were giving their children at the daycare.
Jill Waller from the Shining Star Learning Center talks to GLT's Ryan Denham about the power of social media in the age of outrage. Plus, the end of summer is a magical time to remember the music of the lazy days just gone by, and playfulness, protest, and puppets, a new art exhibit at ISU. And a GLT news update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Social media has changed so much for local businesses, how they find new customers, how they shape their brand, even how they promote upcoming sales. But what happens when it turns on them, when Facebook becomes a threat to their survival? GLT's Ryan Denham looks into one recent example here in Bloomington Normal when a Facebook post was the spark that sent a young mother to jail.
No, you can't get arrested for lying about other people on Facebook. If that were the case, we'd need a lot more jails. But if you lie about something really serious, like child abuse, and then lie about it again to police and Child Protective Services, then you've got a problem. That's allegedly what happened last week when 31-year-old Trisha Donius was arrested. She's charged with filing a false report with the Department of Children and Family Services and obstruction of justice. Here's Normal Police Chief Rick Bleichner on how it all began one Sunday in late August when Donius allegedly posted on Facebook a photo of a child who she said was abused by staff at the Shining Star Learning Center, a daycare in Normal.
We became aware of a social media post. It was reported to us. So once we were made aware of that, our detectives looked at that social media post and realized that that was something that certainly needed to be reported. It would be a mandatory reporter situation if it was a caregiver. So they then reached out to the individual that made the post. And so then started the investigation based on those statements.
Police say Donius stuck by her story that someone at Shining Star abused the child. Police say that's false and that she knew it. Jill Waller is executive director at Shining Star Daycare. She says the past 2 weeks have been traumatic and very frustrating. She appreciates Normal Police for exonerating her business so publicly after the arrest was made, but it was hard for Waller and her staff to keep quiet for more than a week before Donius was arrested. She says they knew the alleged abuse didn't happen at their daycare, but they couldn't say so publicly.
From an outside perspective looking in, it probably looked like we just weren't stating what was going on, but yet we felt we needed to be cooperative with authorities who were completing the investigation. And then once a formal arrest was made, then we were able to say our side of what was happening.
Then last Wednesday, more than a week after the original Facebook post, Donius was arrested. Here's Jill Waller.
It was a huge relief. From the day after the post was made, we had five staff who were under close monitoring supervision from DCFS. And even though we knew they were innocent, we still had to follow procedures from DCFS. And so it was a very much a relief to all of us to know that that was the end of that part. You know, the end is not over because there are complications now because of the post that had been out there about our business. But we will get through that, and we can move on from there.
So what was put on Facebook exactly, and when?
I believe the date was August 27th. It was a Sunday evening. A former mother from our daycare put a post including pictures of physical abuse that had taken place with two of her children, and she was accusing the staff at the daycare for the abuse. And it just went crazy then on Monday, the 28th. I believe there were over 500 shares of that post, and everybody believed it. and you can't believe what's on Facebook. You have to really know your facts. But first impulse, everybody believes what they read. And so from that point on, we had a lot of people doubting the care that we were giving their children at the daycare.
So how does that play out Monday? Are you getting phone calls? Are you getting visits from people, concerned parents?
On Monday, we had numerous calls from parents, former parents, staff, former staff, concerned about what they had read. We immediately contacted our licensing representative at DCFS, so she was aware of the situation. The Norma Police Department contacted us, and then a formal investigation began that morning.
Those hundreds of shares on Facebook reached a wider and wider social network in Bloomington-Normal, far beyond the borders of Don Eustace's actual network of friends. These days, Facebook settings by default are fairly private, meaning your friends are the only ones who will see most posts from most people. But Nate Carpenter, director of Convergent Media and the Social Media Analytics Command Center at ISU's School of Communication, says that's not necessarily an antidote to something going viral.
You know, as you post, especially if you create some interesting content, you know, people are going to share that. So your friends may share that. And when a friend shares something, your friend's friends start to see something. And it can grow like wildfire from there. So you do have to be, you know, cautious about what it is that you share. And again, there are people who are looking for attention. And if they really want attention, they can mark those posts public and make them, you know, able to be shared by anyone.
Police Chief Bleichner says Don Eustace wasn't arrested for the Facebook post. She was arrested for allegedly lying to police and DCFS after they asked her if the allegations were true.
I'm not saying specifically with this case, again, because I want to be cautious with that. But just anytime individuals post things, I think out of human nature, sometimes you may post information or exaggerate that, you know, certain things. But obviously, when you're contacted by officials or authorities inquiring about this and that it's potentially a criminal matter, at that point you need to be upfront. I mean, obviously, it's the easiest thing to say, but sometimes it's the most difficult thing to do. So certainly in that case, had this individual corrected the story, righted the ship there, if you will, we may not have gone down this road. It certainly would not have been a false police report or obstructing justice charges. So this is one of those situations, again, where that continuing with that story, knowing that it was false, was what the concern was.
Normal police went out of their way to exonerate Shining Star in their press release on the arrest last week. It says Shining Star fully and immediately cooperated with detectives. Here's Chief Bleichner.
It's not certainly our part of our mission, I guess, if you will, but certainly one of the things that our detectives were made aware of by employees at the Shining Star Learning Center was that they had received, harassing type phone calls or phone calls in which were, you know, how dare you do these kind of things, that you should be ashamed of ourselves, those kind of things. I mean, as well as we were made aware from the company there that they actually had lost individuals or business as a result of that because people had pulled their children out of the academy there, out of the daycare. And so, again, our investigation throughout the whole thing, they were very cooperative. They were very forthright. They assisted us in that investigation, and through that point, you know, we had nothing to believe that any member of their organization played a part in that. And so because I felt that company had been either an intentional or an unintended victim out of that, and you know, additionally, I felt it was, you know, would be reasonable to include that information in the media release. So that was why I chose to do that. That's why I chose to make that statement. Again, because just to share that, you know, we had no evidence that they've done anything wrong in this case. And again, in fact, they completed fully and cooperated fully with us throughout the course of the investigation.
Okay.
So that's why I felt it was important, again, because I think they did receive, their business could potentially have been harmed and did see some harm as a result of that false statement that was posted out there.
Despite the arrest, Waller is concerned about permanent damage to Shining Star.
We have lost clients over this situation. There are a few families who didn't give specifics why they pulled out, but from the time that post was made till current, we've had 7 children who have dropped out of the center, and that's a financial loss for the daycare. I would hope that we don't have an impact with future clients coming into the center. Hopefully everyone has read what Norma Police Department did put out with total exoneration of our center, and staff, but it just it's been out there, and a lot of people have read it, so I'm sure the damage has been done. We're just going to try to move forward from this point.
Carpenter from ISU's School of Communication notes that big companies have sophisticated social media monitoring tools so they can keep an eye on reputation-threatening comments. That's why you'll likely get a courtesy response or even action if you tweet something bad about an airline or a cable company. They're listening.
I think the hard part is, you know, not very many businesses have the ability to, you know, really be paying attention 24/7. You know, we see really big companies, you know, like credit card companies and airlines, and you know, any you know, major restaurants with big customer service relationships. You know, they're monitoring. You know, they spend, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars to monitor the social web just to, again, kind of, you know, deflect any problems that might come up. And if you're looking at a small community-based, you know, company, like many of which we have here in Bloomington Normal, it's very hard to keep tabs on everything that's going on at all times. So that response is difficult, and I think it really speaks to, you know, again, the need to develop, you know, communities in the social web and to have those really good relationships with customers in the social web.
Social media can be a force for good. Look no further than the recent hurricanes in Texas and Florida and how social media was the catalyst for empowering volunteers or collecting donations. But social media's darker side is what ensnared Waller and her business.
Honestly, I've never been a fan of Facebook. I tell our staff and even my own two children, you've got to be careful what you put out there because it's going to follow you wherever you go. People read it and take it at face value. And unfortunately, what's out there is not always the truth. And in our situation, we were advised not to respond. We did talk to all of our staff and ask that they keep it professional and not react like they would want to. I mean, it's human nature. You want to defend your family, your so-called friends from work.
It's an extraordinary amount of self-control.
Yes, and I was very impressed that everyone remained very professional throughout. It's very difficult when you read not only the posts that this parent had put on there, but then all the comments that people from the community make. We read a lot of comments from former staff who had worked for us that left in a not so positive manner. So then they were lashing back at the daycare, some of the comments they were making. Same thing with some families who had left our center for various reasons. They were reaching out to air their disgruntlement, but you know, we can't respond to that. And we, like I said, we kept it all very professional, but it's difficult to do, but it's a business situation. It's not your personal Facebook. So that's what I kept telling the staff, you know, we can't respond personally. It's a business.
The restraint that Waller and her staff showed by not posting their own response on Facebook after the original allegations is actually a good strategy. Carpenter talks about businesses that are most successful in defending their reputations on social media.
Well, businesses that are successful tend to have a community of supporters around them. In many cases, we talk about you know, in classes that we might teach or examples that we'll look at in the classroom or in client work. We'll talk about, you know, not feeding the trolls or, you know, allowing your community to back you up before you need to even step in and say anything. In most cases, if there's a, you know, legitimate complaint, businesses will try to handle it you know, off of the platform. They want to handle that in private because you don't want to make that any more public than it needs to be. I think, again, when businesses allow their community to step in, again, let's say there's a problem with customer service, you know, most community members who really support that business will step in and say, you know, my experience doesn't match what's going on, or it doesn't, you know, really replicate what we see in the real world. You know, can you elaborate? What was the problem? What was the issue? Again, we see those community members, you know, step in and defend their you know, preferences, or they defend the business that they support. So you know, most businesses will allow that to happen, and they'll allow, you know, we always talk about it as like nature taking its course. Again, that's why it's so important for so many of them to build these solid relationships in the social web. Not only do they get, you know, positive attention, they will get a community of people who will step in and support them when they need it.
Waller is eager to put the episode behind her, and she has some advice for other Bloomington Normal small businesses who may face similar threats to their reputation.
It's difficult to hold back and not say what you want to say, but you have to keep it professional. And in our case, we were just following the advice of what the police department and DCFS were suggesting we do. Other businesses may not have that same support that we did, and we greatly appreciate the support we received from both of those agencies. You just have to be careful what you put out there. I know I said that over and over, but you really do need to be careful what is said.
That's Jill Waller, executive director of a Shining Star Learning Center. Before that, it was Nate Carpenter from ISU's School of Communication and Normal Police Chief Rick Bleichner. I'm Ryan Denham.
Jessa Daniels, the Normal mother who was arrested last week in the case, faces two Class 4 felony charges. She's due back in court September 15th for an arraignment.
Support for GLT's Sound Ideas comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd, helping investors plan for the future and stay on track for retirement and college savings based on their unique situations and goals. Details at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, pictures and puppets. Illinois is still trying to find ways to make a crushing $15 billion load of unpaid bills more bearable. That's the talk of the Illinois Politics Roundtable. Charlie Wheeler's with the University of Illinois at Springfield. Brian Mackey is the State House reporter for IPR. Matt Dietrich is a writer for PolitiFact with the Illinois Better Government Association. And the moderator is IPR's Sean Crawford. The state is borrowing more money, and Brian Mackey says for a change, a lot of people wanted to see that happen.
Well, during the budget impasse, Illinois built up a $15 billion backlog of bills. And it had this even before the budget impasse in a much smaller way. But this is basically the state was issuing contracts for services, things like food for the prisoners, gasoline for our state police cars, as well as people who take care of people with disabilities or people who are can't leave their homes for whatever reasons. You know, these are things that the state contracts to do, but we didn't have the money in a lot of cases to pay these vendors. So we just kept adding to this huge pile of IOUs, which grew to be about $15 billion. Just to put that in context, that's somewhere between half and a third, maybe 35-40% of our annual general revenue expenditures every year. I think the budget this past year was around in the area of $37 billion. So that's just a huge pile of money we owe to Illinois, in a lot of cases, Illinois-based businesses. So fast forward to the budget agreement that comes through a couple months ago over the summer. It included an element to borrow money to begin paying some of this more quickly, both to get relief to some of these vendors, but also to lower the interest rates. Something I didn't mention is some of these vendors get as much as 12% interest penalties per year. So the state is paying, I've seen one estimate, $800 million a year in interest penalties on this backlog. So the idea is pay off those high interest ones more quickly at, you know, the rate that the state could borrow money, which is from the market, which is probably going to be closer to 4 or 5%.
And Charlie, is this a smart move to do this?
Oh, I think it is. And to be honest, I couldn't figure out why the governor didn't want to do it sooner. Talking about too much borrowing, well, I think Comptroller Mendoza nailed it on the head. We are borrowing, but the people we're borrowing from are folks who aren't in the business of lending money. It's the providers, it's school districts, it's everybody to whom the state owes money that can't be paid because we just don't have the cash. And as was noted, on some of this debt, we're paying 12% interest, 1% a month on these past due payments. No matter what you may think of the state's credit worthiness, and the state has got the lowest credit rating of any state in the union, you'll still be able to sell bonds at a lot less than 12%. So as I say, to me, it was a no-brainer. Why not borrow the money from people who are in the business of doing lending, rather than imposing it upon small businesses, school districts, human service providers, folks who are desperate for the money, some of them going out of business because they don't have it.
And Matt, it seems as though this is the type of thing that I think it falls under the radar for a lot of folks, but this is really a drain on the Illinois economy when you have these businesses not getting paid for all of this work, and you're seeing this amount of, what, $15 billion. That doesn't help the economy of the state.
No, it's money that has come out of the state already, and people are just waiting to be paid and waiting and waiting and waiting. So you're exactly right, Sean. It is a big hole that's carved out of the Illinois economy.
So, Charlie, you mentioned they can get a better interest rate. Talk about why that 12% exists in the beginning. I mean, that's a high rate, and that was sort of self-imposed, correct?
Oh, yeah. That was a law that was passed a few years ago, I guess several years ago now. And the idea was to put a hammer over the head of the state so that these vouchers would be processed more quickly and folks would be paid what they were owed more quickly. It was not seen as going to be part of everyday business where we're paying, the comptroller says, $2 million a day in these interest fees. Rather, it was sort of put there as, if you don't keep up to date with what you're supposed to be doing, here's the penalty. So obviously you don't want the penalty, so you're going to keep up to date.
Okay, now let me move on to the fact that they borrow money and there's going to have to be some way to pay off these bonds. Brian, what are they talking about, or what are you hearing when it comes to a way to do that?
Well, the people will, especially Democrats, will point out that these are not revenue bonds. These are not tied to a specific source of, you know, a specific tax, a license plate fee or a gasoline we've seen in the past, things like that. This is general obligation bonds. So it just comes out of the, you know, it gets added to the pile of the things that the state has to use its full faith, credit, and taxing authority to make good on, which Controller Mendoza pointed out, Illinois always has done. We have never defaulted on payments to the bondholders, even when it has meant hurting and delaying payments to people who take care of vulnerable populations.
Brian Mackey is State House reporter for IPR. Matt Dietrich is a writer for PolitiFact with the Illinois Better Government Association. And Charlie Wheeler is the head of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois at Springfield. And together with moderator Sean Crawford, they make up the Illinois Politics Roundtable.
Hello.
Well, we did ask.
I love GLT.
And most of you took us seriously when we asked you to call 309-438-WGLT and tell us why you contribute.
It's my reality check to find out what's happening in the world.
I listened to your show. It was fantastic.
Join these listeners. Tell us why GLT is your public radio station and tell us why you contribute. Call 438-WGLT.
Over and out.
Support for GLT comes from ESA, Eye Surgical Associates, providing innovative treatment and eye-correcting surgeries for a wide range of eye conditions, including cataracts, macular degeneration, diabetic retinopathy, and glaucoma. You can see the difference at eyesurgicalassociates.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, summer music. Gotta love it. A gigantic witch puppet, both imposing and comical, dominates a new exhibition at the Illinois State University Galleries that uses playfulness to explore activism and protest. GLT's Laura Kennedy has more.
Past and present activism runs through the latest work from Philadelphia-based artist Amy Cousins. The show is called You Will Never Have the Comfort of Our Silence Again, and includes large-scale sculptures and installations that sprung from rare protest ephemera and out-of-print feminist newspapers. In creating her new exhibition, Cousins looked within, but she also looked to the past, deep into archival material.
I have spent a lot of time digging around in archives at the William Way Community Center in Philadelphia, an LGBT center, and they have some really amazing things, and it stemmed from my interest in wanting to know that history within the city I was living in and that history of the queer community. I was looking to create. I had done some more personal research in previous work relating to where my family's from and histories there and how people were perceived, how queer people were perceived in newspapers specifically, mainstream newspapers. And so then I thought, well, what about in our own words? And so then I started looking at gay newspapers and radical newspapers that circulated in the gay liberation era, and I found some really exciting stuff. So kind of went from there.
Tell me about the stuff you found that really got you excited.
Yeah, as soon as I heard about this witch puppet, my eyes kind of lit up. This was a group called Dyke Tactics in Philadelphia in the 70s, and they did a number of things. They did protests outside of snuff films, but this particularly was a protest of an equal rights bill, the death of an equal rights bill that was going to die on the floor. And so they went down to City Hall, and they borrowed a witch puppet from a friend. They took a banner that said, "You will never have the comfort of our silence again." And the witch was cackling some kind of crazy things about, "I am the lesbian trapped inside every woman. I am the woman trapped inside every man," just really going for it. And I was so struck by the playfulness and the boldness of this statement. And in the face of what ended up being some real violence and authoritarian violence, the police really beat these women up at this protest. And so I was fascinated by this figure of the witch puppet, but I never actually found an image of it. And then that led me to create her in my own mind and what she stood for, and spinning that stereotype of this lesbian witch spinster character and making her this goddess and queer monument.
So that's the result of your imaginings, of your creation. Mm-hmm. I mean, you could have made it something that could easily have, you know, appeared on the Muppet Show size kind of a thing, but instead you made this gigantic sculpture. Mm-hmm. Why so large, and what were you trying to achieve with the size and the look and so forth?
All I knew about the puppet from various descriptions was that it was somewhere between 10 and 15 feet tall, and it was orange. And then I started looking into the history of radical puppetry, as particularly Bread and Puppet, a group in Vermont that engaged in puppetry and protest and political theater. And their trademark style were kind of big head, big hands, and then just drapey clothes. They weren't always super well crafted, because their motto was kind of like, you might have to drop it to run from the police. And so I wanted to reference that history as well, because I think that's also really exciting and inspiring.
It's a puppet, and there's a sort of a subversive playfulness going on there too.
Yeah, there's a subversive playfulness, and then there's also this implied teamwork and interaction. So my puppet would need three people to carry it. They would need one person for each hand post, one person to hold the body, and another person for the other hand. And so that's all embedded in the form and the material.
Amy Cousins first came to the University Gallery's attention in a juried group show the gallery hosted last year. Curator Jason Judd says they were so impressed with Cousins' work that they bestowed the Curator's Choice Award upon her entry. An invitation to show a collection of her work at the gallery soon followed. Judd says Cousins' work speaks to this moment in time with its emphasis on activism and protest, with a subversive playfulness.
These are very heavy themes, incredibly serious to many, many people. And one thing about her work is it's very accessible, and I think a lot of it is about distance, right? And we have these big windows, and you look into this space, and you see this large papier-mâché person, you see this text that looks very fun and fuzzy, you see this patent leather box that's a vitrine, right? So when you walk in, then you hear this dance music. So when you walk in, everything is kind of bright and colorful and a little bit festive. And then as you get closer, the content, the seriousness starts revealing itself to you, all the way up to reading the actual text on the wall and then thinking about that, or walking up to the 13-foot witch and reading the pin, you know, that says, "Do the police a favor, beat yourself up." And it becomes very in your face at that point.
In addition to her sculpture work and static installations, Cousins is employing the Queer Dance Party as part of her show, coming up on October 7th at 9 p.m. in the gallery space. Cousins sees the dance party as a survival tactic to celebrate yourself and your identity in the face of oppression.
I went to a queer dance party protest outside of the Lowe's Hotel in Philadelphia when the GOP had a retreat there. And it was so amazing because people were angry, but they were also joyful, and they were dancing, and they had signs. and they're shouting, and it, like, the combination of those emotions was so moving to me that we could do both, that we didn't have to sacrifice our joy and our expression in order to make ourselves heard, and then we didn't have to try to live up to standards of respectability. And then when I started looking into those histories, I found that in the early 70s, this rich history of gay liberation dances, particularly at college campuses. And I started looking at flyers, and it was fascinating to me that rarely was it a gay dance without liberation in the title, that just the act of bringing your queer bodies together and moving them in a space was political, that it was this radical act to dance together. And so they were parties, but it was, in a way, a protest. And so it is this lineage that we've inherited.
Curator Jason Judd says even before the dance party, gallery visitors can get a taste of such an event in a specially roped-off area of the gallery.
There's a pre-dance party that is going on, that is an installation in the gallery, in which a playlist of wonderful dance songs plays throughout the space with a furry disco ball and images of queer dance protests that have happened since 2016. So the queer dance party really emanates from the Orlando tragedy and shooting, which was one of the most horrific acts of violence against the queer community. Coming from that, Work for Peace is a group and project where they started celebrating that as a dance party in memory of that tragedy. So that keeps folding into it actually being activism, people using that celebration to protest. So what Amy is doing is she's bringing that celebration, that activism, into the art gallery, right? So I think it's very relevant that she asked that question while everybody's dancing in the gallery among each other, why are you dancing? And I think she asked that question very poignantly. To really experience the show, coming out and participating in the dance party is something. I think to truly have your body in the space, among the artwork, with the invited DJs, and with other people, you really get a sense of her work with the body, with inclusiveness, with rights, and to really support people's civil rights.
Cousins says having the dance party and exhibition on a university campus is very meaningful to her.
When I did a piece it's a bulletin board where I've recreated some of the old flyers, and they would have been on university campuses. And so I like thinking about the idea of it returning to a university campus. I think what I've done, it's an homage, and it honors the work of those who came before me, and so...
So maybe you could be part of a continuum.
Yeah, it would be, I guess, yeah, part of that lineage. That would be exciting, yeah.
What do you hope the gallery visitor, the casual gallery visitor, gets out of your work?
Well, my hope is that there are different points of accessibility in the work. I think a lot of the materials I'm using, like these kind of faux furs and shiny fabrics, they have a seductive quality, and I think they invite people in. But I also know that there's maybe a limit for a lot of people. There's a back section of the gallery that these lavender shag papier-mâché stanchions lead you into a black curtain. And just from being in the gallery, I've seen people be reticent to enter the curtain. You know, maybe not everyone will go in there, but those who do are rewarded with what they find. And that's okay. You know, I'm hoping that everyone can take away something different. I've had a lot of people say, oh my God, I've never heard of this. And I'm like, no, there's no reason you would have. That's why I wanted to make the work, because these events were so important to me, but were not largely remembered by society and our institutions.
But do you think that's going to change?
No, I don't think it's necessarily going to change just from my putting this work out there on the grand scale, but individually, person to person, if it means as much to one person that it meant to me finding this information, then that's exciting.
The message in Cousins' art draws its power from her creativity and focus as an artist. Curator Jason Judd says the fact that she's folded activism within art can draw a wide audience.
As much as her work is protest, is activism, it's also contemporary art, right? So it is reflexive on itself. And art history, the history of craft, you know, the history of textile and appliqué figures, the history of puppetry, the history of text and design, the history of printmaking, So what makes Amy such an incredible artist is not only the potent content, but the inclusiveness in which she brings to material, content, and how she also approaches that, right? She approaches it with a sense of celebration, with a sense of ingenuity, right? And that ingenuity is what drew her to these protests in the first place.
That's curator Jason Judd and artist Amy Cousins. Her exhibition, You Will Never Have the Comfort of Our Silence Again, is on view at the University Galleries through October 8th. While at the university, Cousins will also be doing a printmaking collaboration with the Normal Editions Workshop. I'm Laura Kennedy.
You can see photos from Amy Cousins' exhibition at our website, WGLT.org. One of the songs Cousins says is featured at queer dance parties is this one, I Will Survive.
I was petrified, kept thinking I could never live without you by my side. But then I spent so many nights thinking how you did me wrong, and I grew strong, and I learned how.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Summer's concert season, and rock fans like the past season, are still clamoring to see icons. They have the draw, but do they still have it? GLT culture commentator and ISU English professor Bill McBride set aside some summertime to enjoy concerts. His schedule, Dead & Company at Wrigley in June, Paul McCartney at Tinley Park in June, George Thorogood at the BCPA in Bloomington, and back to Wrigley to see Billy Joel August 11th. McBride thinks all of the acts protested President Trump in their own way. He says the highlight for him was seeing a former Beatle, McCartney, performing 39 songs over almost 3 hours. McBride called the experience incredible.
I'm old enough to have been there in front of my black and white television in 64 watching Ed Sullivan. And I've been a Beatle fan ever since, and I'm not alone. And I lost it. I mean, I was a Beatle. It was Beatlemania. I was screaming like many of the gals around me.
He opened with that classic chord, right?
Oh.
From A Hard Day's Night,
yeah.
Right?
It's been a hard day's night, and I've been working like a dog. It's been a hard day's night, I should be sleeping like a log. But when I get home
did
to
he,
you...
Goosebumps?
Yeah, he did John songs. He did all kinds of things.
Is there a musical moment other than, you know, the opening song, A Hard Day's Night, that stood out for you?
There were two. I would say that when he dedicated Maybe I'm Amazed to Linda.
Oh, yeah, let's listen to that, and then we'll talk about
it
afterwards.
Maybe I'm amazed the way you love me all the time. Maybe I'm afraid of the way I love you. Maybe I'm amazed.
So this song he dedicated to Linda, Maybe I'm Amazed. Paul McCartney played that at his concert at Tinley Park. Why this moment in this concert for you, Bill?
So I reviewed that record when it first came out, the McCartney record, in my high school newspaper, and was just, okay, I'm going to say it, amazed that he plays all of the instruments. He wrote it all. He kind of impersonates Harrison on guitar and Ringo on drums. At the show, it was just, you know, there's been some question about his voice. I thought his voice was fine. Yes, he's in his 70s. He's a little older. He's not that... Oh, he's still cute. But he's not that mop top who could hit all the notes. It's true. But it did not distract at all or detract.
So you heard music written by Lennon and McCartney for the Beatles during the Beatle era. There's Paul McCartney and Wings. They played some of that stuff, which is great stuff.
Yeah.
And then there's simply solo McCartney stuff. What was the strongest for you? And do you think it depended... the strongest stuff for one concert goer wasn't the strongest stuff for another.
Oh, undoubtedly, right?
Everybody has their favorites.
Yeah. But I mean, and you know, folks have come into his career at different stages. I've seen it from the beginning, and I've heard it from the beginning. So I'm giving you that, you know, the whole smorgasbord reaction. And I was in heaven. I had never seen a Beatle live, and I saw one. And I guess I never really, even though I loved and followed his solo career, I always think of him as a Beatle.
One of the reviews I read gave a lot of props to his band, and they talked about how McCartney was part of the band, the leader of this band, not just an icon propped up in front of a backing band.
Absolutely. You're right. It was not, you know, Doc Severinsen up front, and you don't know all everyone else's nameless. He introduced everybody, and they were wonderful. They were spot on. I mean, you know, he's allegedly a taskmaster. So if you're going to play for McCartney, you're going to be spot on, and they were.
That's Sound Ideas culture commentator Bill McBride. We're talking with him about his summer concert experiences. He saw some icons this summer, including The Dead and Company on June 30th at Wrigley Field. Is the mystique still there without Jerry Garcia?
No and yes. So the mystique, you know, Bob Weir, who I think was 15 when the band started, he is so much part of the band, and I'm going to say the crowd. I mean, the Deadheads. Wrigley Field filled up with all of these happy people. I mean, they're
so great. Wrigley got a mellow Dead vibe to it.
It totally did. And we had a nice little spot. We stood and danced right on first base. And, you know, they were a ways away out there in center field. But they've got monitors. You know, same with McCartney.
How does John Mayer sound in place of Jerry? And beyond a replacement for Garcia, what does he bring to the band?
Right. So, I mean, I don't put him in that spot. He does a little of the Jerry stuff, but it's mostly Bob Weir. And John Mayer was not a huge factor. I hope his people aren't listening, but he just blended in, I would say.
So just another member of the band.
He struck me as so, yes.
Was there a song where you turned the corner from the Grateful Dead to the Dead and Company and sort of said, okay, well, maybe it's not the Dead, but it's enough like the Dead, and that's good enough?
Well, so my favorite song was the song they ended with, their encore.
U.S. Blues?
U.S. Blues, Uncle Sam's Blues. Now, that's a Jerry song, and Jerry sings it. But Weir sang it, and it was lovely, and it was authentic.
Let's listen to a little of U.S. Blues. It's the Dead and Company.
Pretty and white, blue state shoes.
U.S. Blues, The Grateful Dead. Why this song?
Well, because it spoke to me about the current situation in America since November. And in fact, every concert I went to, there was a nod to Trump.
We'll get to that in a moment. Staying local for the next concert on your summer list.
Yeah, yeah.
How does George Thorogood at the BCPA rate in the same league as McCartney, The Dead, and Billy Joel, who we'll talk about in just a moment?
Okay, that's fine.
Or does George Thorogood rate in that list?
He does for me in the following ways. First off, I had a radio show in the 80s at the University of Delaware, and he was listening to my show in his car with his band. And he called me on a 1983 or whatever it was car phone and said, "I love your show, man. Can I stop by?" So he came in the studio.
Really?
Yeah. I think I was playing like some Butthole Surfer or something that he called up and liked. And so I've always loved him for that. You know, so he's a sort of a local pride there for Delaware.
Sure.
And that I had my brush.
So I don't know if I think of him as an icon. Bad to the Bone, that song is iconic, though.
Yes.
Does George still have the skills on the guitar?
Oh, amen.
And the band, the Destroyers, too? I mean, most of the original Destroyers are still with him.
He's got a good number of them. Yeah. I mean, I would say my favorite song he did and my favorite George Thorogood song is Move It On Over. I think that's terrific. But and that's a Hank Williams song. So he's resurrected that, which I always love when artists do that, resurrect classic Americana.
He did that with John Lee Hooker's song, too, One Scotch, One Bourbon, One Beer.
Yeah, absolutely.
So the George Thorogood concert, how did it rate compared to everything else that we've talked about so far?
They're
apples
all
and oranges, somewhat,
it
but
is,
still.
It is. It's apples and oranges. And I'm just delighted I was able to spend this time. I didn't take a vacation this summer. I was teaching and also doing another seminar thing, so we didn't get away, but we got to concerts.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy in the studio with Bill McBride, and this is Billy Joel.
Come out, Virginia, don't let me wait. Catholic girls start much too late. Oh, but sooner or later it comes down to fate. I might as well be the one. Well, they showed
told you the price that you pay, the things that you might have done. Only the good die young.
Only the Good Die Young, Billy Joel, appropriate because you've seen some great musicians who are still at it, including the piano man himself, Billy Joel. You saw him on August 11th. I listened to a lot of Billy Joel until New Wave took over my life in the late 70s. At Wrigley, he apologized for not having any new material. Would the audience have wanted to hear that anyway?
Well, Sir Paul did a couple of new things, and they were tolerated. But we want what we want. And you say that you were a Billy Joel fan until New Wave. I always admired him from afar. I claimed him because he's a New Yorker, as I am, and we have the same first name. We stopped there. But my wife adores Billy Joel, and that is why we went to that show, and I'm so glad we did.
At Wrigley, he gave the audience down on the field fielder's choice. What did he do?
So he said, it's a maddening poll. Do you want to hear Vienna or Just the Way You Are? And folks screamed more for Vienna, and I wanted to hear Just the Way. But he just dangled it in front of you.
He did that several times, too, right?
He did. He said, choose Longest Time or Innocent Man. And I mean, I kind of know Longest Time, but I didn't really know Innocent Man. Incidentally, the band warmed up with The Lion Sleeps Tonight to do that.
Really?
He quoted Zeppelin. He did Rock and Roll. They quoted Day in the Life and Hard Day's Night. Elton John's Your Song. Chicago's 25 or 6 to 4. He even did Puccini's Nessa Dorma. So, I mean, he's a musician and he knows what he's doing.
You wanted to focus on a 1977 song, Moving Out, from this concert. Let's listen to a little of that, and then we'll talk about why.
Mama Leone left a note on the door. She said, Sonny, move out to the country. I've been working too hard to give you a heart attack. You want to know by now. Who needs a house out in Hackensack? Is that all you get for your money? Waste of time. If that's what it's all about, Mama, if that's moving up, then I'm moving out.
Moving Out from Billy Joel, played about halfway through his Wrigley Field concert on August 11th. We're talking with Sound Ideas culture commentator Bill McBride about some of the summer icons he saw, or some of the rock icons he saw this summer. Why did you want to talk about Moving Out?
I wanted you to play it. I don't have a lot to say about it. It was, for me, the highlight of the show. I thought he nailed it, and it opened up the song to me in a way I hadn't. It had just been a hit on the radio. I'd never really paid attention to it, other than the heart attack, and it was just the highlight for me.
So these performers, they're all getting older. That's one thing they have in common. Joel sounds huskier. You referenced McCartney's voice earlier. What did you think of Billy Joel's singing ability?
Billy Joel was spot on. I mean, it could have been 1977, other than his male pattern baldness. I mean, he was terrific.
We all get that.
Well, some more than
we should
others.
Take a side-by-side picture. And something else you think they all had in common was a protest of sorts. They all did it a different way, but a protest against President Trump. What did the Dead and Company do? Was it the song U.S. Blues?
I think so. I mean, they didn't call him out. No one called Trump out. That's right, because you don't know who your audience. I mean, you know most of your audience, but you don't want to alienate someone. So, yeah, they ended with I've got the Uncle Sam blues. Hmm. And that was my reading that it was.
What about McCartney?
Well, McCartney did a song called 1985, which is an apocalyptic song. No one left alive in 1985. He wrote it in 73, I think. But the notion of nuclear war and so on that we're all contemplating a little more closely these days, I thought that was a potential nod anyway.
George Thorogood, he had a Trump protest of sorts.
Oh, he opened his show with the lights down, and he played the entire 1964 Barry McGuire song, Eve of Destruction. And you know he paid the rights for that, and he gave over that 2.5 minutes of his show, And it just makes the audience wonder why.
Sure.
And I think I have an answer.
So Billy Joel got some press for something he did after Charlottesville, but he also, you say he also acknowledged Trump during his Chicago concert. Can you talk about both?
Yeah. He sang Maria from West Side Story, but he redid the lyrics to Korea. And that's a clear indication of the business going on right now with North Korea and the rattling of nuclear sabers.
And after Charlottesville, he wore the Star of David at some concerts.
At Madison Square Garden, yeah. He wore an enormous Star of David on both the front and the back of his jacket. He's not religious or he's not practicing, but he was born of Jewish parents. And that, I think, as well, you're right. It was right after Charlottesville, and it's a reaction to the current administration.
Bill McBride is an ISU English professor and our Sound Ideas culture commentator. Bill, thanks for sharing your experiences with us. We appreciate it.
My pleasure.
The next concert on Bill's list is Brian Wilson of Beach Boys fame. He'll perform the complete Pet Sounds album at an October 8th concert at the Peoria Civic Center. Bill talked with GLT's Mike McCurdy. This is Sound Ideas. You're listening to Wouldn't It Be Nice from Pet Sounds. You can find individual stories and interviews from Sound Ideas by Ryan Denham and Laura Kennedy at our website, WGLT.org. Like us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org. Hold each other close.